There's no free lunch when it comes to investing. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast. I don't know why I've said welcome back for like 300 episodes, Greg.
Yeah, and you know, you hope that people are coming back, although some people might just be new listeners, in which case you're not welcoming them back, you're just welcoming them.
Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast.
Right on.
With Greg and Colin.
Yep.
Welcome back, Greg.
Thanks. You too. Welcome back, Colin.
Thank you. Today we are talking about something that everybody should be focused on, something called happiness.
Right.
It's kind of a big thing, right?
Yes. Yep, for sure.
Just had a meeting with somebody actually just before recording here, and we were talking about the difference between being rich and being wealthy.
Yep.
And one of them is focused on dollars in the bank, and the other one's focused more on things like happiness, right?
Exactly. Yep, that's right.
So you prepared this episode, and I'm thankful that you did. I'm happy that you did, Greg.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy that you're happy.
Yeah, no, I'm super happy. We're going to talk about what makes countries happy. Why do some nations consistently top the rankings while others lag behind?
Yep.
And it's all focused around this thing called the World Happiness Report.
Exactly.
Comes out every year, right?
Yep.
It looks at things like social support, health, income, trust, freedom, and generosity. All of those things are at question right now as the U.S. president speaks in Davos, but that's a whole other episode.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's an episode we probably will never record.
Probably not, because we don't want to have our true feelings either way out there on
exactly
those things. But
yeah,
for years, we've got Nordic countries like Finland, Denmark, and Iceland who have been at the top of that happiness list,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But beyond the headlines, there's some deeper dynamics that we're going to explore. So which countries are the happiest and unhappiest?
Yeah.
Where Canada and the U.S. rank in that? How social safety nets like healthcare and pensions affect happiness?
Yep.
Why tax systems differ between happy and unhappy countries? Is anybody ever happy paying tax, Greg?
No, I don't think so.
Not usually.
And yet, there may be reasons to be happy about paying tax.
Well, that'll be interesting to get into.
Yep.
What lessons we can draw from global patterns. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at.
Sure.
Happy to proceed?
Unhappy. So let's talk about, first of all, who's happy and who isn't.
Okay.
So starting with the leaderboard, and this is the most recent rankings for 2025, and the top happiest countries are, number one, Finland.
Yeah.
Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Netherlands, Costa Rica, Norway, Israel, Luxembourg, and Mexico. And
wait, when's this list from?
This is 2025.
Okay.
Yeah, reported by Forbes. And these results, they kind of repeat year after year with modest variations. So, but Finland in particular has held the number one spot for multiple years in a row. Then on the other end, the lowest ranked countries typically include places that face some major challenges, whether it's war and conflict, political instability, or humanitarian crises. And so those countries would include Afghanistan, Sierra Leone, Lebanon, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Democratic Republic of Congo, Yemen, and others.
Like Minnesota? Does Minnesota make the list?
It doesn't.
Okay.
It's not a country, as you know. So when you look at those countries, I mean, they differ in culture, geography, and history, but they share some of the same, you know, basic issues, which are low income, high insecurity, and limited social support systems.
Yep.
What's interesting is that happiness rankings don't track perfectly with wealth. So if you look, Mexico regularly ranks high despite middle income status. And the United States, which is one of the world's wealthiest countries, has been sliding down the rankings for years. So let's
talk. Like a lot right now.
Exactly. So let's talk about where Canada and the U.S. stand. So Canada currently ranks around 18th happiest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Still top 20, but it's a drop compared to some earlier years when Canada recently scored in the top 10. However, it is number one among the G7 countries, so go Canada.
Yeah, there you go.
United States.
Elbows up, as they say.
Exactly. United States, meanwhile, is down around the 24th, which is its lowest position since they started looking at these rankings.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on? Well, in both countries, there's been some similar trends, a rise in social isolation, some declining trust in institutions, worsening mental health, especially among younger people, and increased economic anxiety, even with strong GDP numbers that, you know, that our countries experience. And in the U.S. specifically, people report less confidence in the future, higher loneliness, greater political polarization, and higher out-of-pocket medical costs. So, you know, when you look at Canada, loneliness and declining self-reported life satisfaction are major factors. And older Canadians, interestingly, tend to report higher happiness than younger Canadians. And that's a pattern that's seen across a lot of the developed world, not just in Canada.
Wait, sorry. So the older Canadians tend to report higher happiness than younger Canadians.
Correct.
You know, I actually have an issue with that because you talk about, so in the U.S., higher loneliness, greater polarization,
yep,
et cetera.
Yep.
I think there's a big problem with single retirees,
yep,
that have a huge loneliness,
sure,
issue,
sure,
that would contribute to, and I think about some family members that live alone, right?
Yep.
And they're alone all day and they watch TV a lot,
yep,
which maybe fuels a certain political polarization.
Yep. Yep.
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that's probably true. And again, it's not to say that these surveys say that all older Canadians are happy and all younger Canadians are unhappy.
Yeah.
But I think what we've seen in both Canada and the U.S. is that a lot of younger people, they have, you know, difficulty maybe finding jobs. They have difficulty finding partners.
Yeah.
They can't afford to buy homes. The average age of buying a new house has been increasing in both Canada and the U.S. for the last 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there are a lot of things that currently affect younger individuals than maybe was the case in the past.
Right.
It's something that that we've seen and is contributing to the decline in the rankings of both Canada and the U.S.
Yeah.
But a clear takeaway is that economic wealth alone of a country doesn't guarantee happiness. And so the next key element that I want to talk about are things like social safety nets.
Okay, before you get there, there's actually, I remember watching I think it was a Netflix show about happiness, and it showed different people in different countries and the general level of happiness.
Yep.
And it was some of the poorest countries were actually some of the happiest people.
Yep.
Very strange to think about.
Right? Can be, for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway. So back to social safety nets. So one of the themes that comes out of the happiness research is that security matters. And we're not just talking about physical security, but, you know, social and economic security. So when you look at social safety nets, we're talking about programs such as universal or public health care, pensions and retirement income, unemployment insurance, child care support, disability benefits, affordable education, and social housing.
Mm-hmm.
And these provide a baseline of protection so that if somebody gets sick, loses a job, or ages out of the workforce, they're not left destitute. And so let's take a look at how these influence happiness. First of all, there's reduced stress and uncertainty. So if you don't have to worry about medical bankruptcy or retiring into poverty, everyday life feels less, you know, precarious.
Sure.
Chronic stress is one of the strongest predictors of low well-being, so reducing stress has major benefits. And so certainly things like medical bankruptcy, ironically, you hear, you know, that coming out of the U.S. more than many other countries, and just because of their mostly private healthcare system.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. does have public health care, certainly for people over 65 or people in the lowest income brackets. But that's one of the biggest issues is just that concern. Secondly, there's greater trust in society. So, you know, trust is a big piece of that whole puzzle. In the happiest countries, people tend to trust their governments, trust their neighbors, and trust that the system works fairly. And safety nets reinforce that trust by demonstrating that society will support you when needed. More social connection. If you're working three jobs to afford healthcare, you don't really have time for relationships. So countries with stronger safety nets give people more time for family and community. And both of those contribute, you know, to happiness in a significant way. Improved physical and mental health. So healthy life expectancy is used directly in the happiness rankings, and universal healthcare system deliver better population health outcomes with lower costs.
That makes sense.
Try to convince certain countries of that.
Which countries are you referring to?
Oh, just, you know, just maybe significantly large, you know, economically and militarily strong countries you might see in the world.
Oh, like one just south to us?
Sure.
Okay.
And lastly, more freedom and opportunity. So people in strong welfare states often report that they feel free to make life choices, whether that's switching careers, starting a business, or having children. And if you contrast that with countries where one medical bill can bankrupt you, or where retiring without savings is dangerous, that fear limits freedom. So it's not an accident that the Nordic countries, I mean Finland, Denmark, Norway, Iceland, Sweden, they all combine high public services, low corruption, strong governance, high trust, and strong social safety nets, which consistently leads to high happiness.
I feel like the people of Finland came up a couple of years ago, well, with this Russia-Ukraine incursion.
Mm-hmm.
Because doesn't Finland share a border with Russia?
They do indeed. A very long border.
And Finland, are they part of NATO?
They are indeed.
Yeah. And so there was a worry that, talking about like safety and freedom,
yeah,
there was some worry that maybe they'd be next.
Yeah, and it probably does remain a concern for them. And of course, being part of NATO now, I think that gives them a lot more reassurance maybe than they had a number of years ago before they became part of NATO.
Sure.
What we're talking about sounds a lot like people might say, oh, gee, that's socialism. And, you know, here we're not talking here about whether or not we think socialism is good or bad. We're just discussing statistics.
Yeah.
And so the statistics are pretty strong that these countries have the highest happiness ratings.
Yeah.
Take that for what you will.
Yeah.
So I also wanted to look at the tax side of the story because, of course, countries that provide strong social services like universal health care and retiring pensions and things like that, they have to get the money from somewhere.
This is a discussion we've had in our house many times around election times.
Yep.
Because my wife and I tend to vote differently. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter how we vote, and we'll get into that.
Yeah.
I'm right, she's wrong.
There's always room for discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the discussions we have is like how we need more hospitals and we need more schools and things like that.
Yeah.
That's one person's side of the discussion. Mm-hmm. The other person's side of the discussion is, and how do you pay for it?
Right. And that's where funding or taxation comes in, right? Because the money has to come from somewhere. And so I wanted to take a look at, well, what are the tax systems in the high happiness countries relative to the low happiness countries? It turns out that the high happiness countries also have high tax revenue as a percentage of GDP. So when you look at countries like Denmark and Finland, they collect around 40 to 45% of GDP in taxes.
That's
with Sweden and Norway fairly close behind. And that's significantly higher than countries like the U.S., where tax revenue is closer to 25 to 27% of GDP. There's high personal tax rates as well. Like in Finland and Denmark, they could be paying 53 to 55% of income tax at the top rates.
Yeah.
Turns out that's not all that different than certain provinces in Canada.
Yeah.
But certainly higher than the U.S. Another characteristic of those high happiness countries is they tend to have progressive income taxes. As I said, you know, the top marginal rates in some of those Nordic countries are over 50%. People, you know, sometimes assume that high taxes make people unhappy, but surveys consistently show Nordic citizens feel they get value for their taxes in the form of healthcare, education, pension, childcare, public transit, and parental leave. Taxes aren't really seen as a loss, but a contribution towards security that's shared by all of the, you know, all of the citizens.
Sure. But I mean, you could say the same thing about Cuba.
Yep.
Right? I mean, like people of Cuba get healthcare, education,
yep,
childcare, public transit.
Yep.
I don't know where they would rank.
And I don't have that exact number where they rank, but it would be interesting to look at.
Yeah. Well, so, and there's this idea that they're also a communist country.
Yeah.
There's that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So third, low happiness countries tend to have low tax capacity. So when you look at some of the unhappiest countries in the world, they often collect low taxes relative to GDP and sometimes under 10 to 15%. So again, compare that to the, you know, the happy countries of 40 to 45% of GDP. You know, and some of the reasons for that low tax capacity are informal economies, weak institutions, low administrative capacity, corruption, and conflict or instability. Mm-hmm. And so these countries often rely on sales taxes or import duties and not broad income taxation, which limits revenue and prevents investment in things like their healthcare system, pension programs, education, and infrastructure, which we've talked about.
I wonder what they mean by informal economies, like just private markets? Or?
A number of years ago, Greece was becoming insolvent.
Yeah.
And
as was Portugal, yeah, Italy.
And part of the problem was that people didn't pay taxes.
Yeah.
And they were unable to actually collect taxes from citizens. And so so when paying taxes become optional rather than mandatory, the revenue dries up and you aren't able to pay your debts.
It's like, wait, I don't have to. I'm just encouraged.
Yes, I choose not to. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I remember that time. That was the pigs, as they called it, right? Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain.
Yes.
That was back in the global financial crisis days. And yeah, I remember talking to people about Greece, and it was like a badge of honor if you could get a full pension and never have paid taxes.
Exactly.
Crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So, without revenue, governments can't build the services that reduce insecurity and improve well-being. So obviously that can lead to very low happiness scores. So when you map tax capacity and happiness scores, you can see a clear relationship. The high tax, high service nations consistently rank among the happiest, and low tax, low capacity nations struggle to invest in their people. Here's the important point, is that happiness isn't just about taxes. It's about what societies get in return for those taxes.
Sure.
So it might be a little simplistic to say, well, high taxes means happiness and low taxes means unhappiness, because it's not quite right. So if you look at some of the high happiness countries, I mentioned Costa Rica and Mexico, they don't have extremely high taxes, but what they do have are strong cultural, connections, social support, and a sense of community.
And delicious food.
And very delicious food. But you look at the United States, which is a wealthy, innovative, and relatively low tax country, but ranks outside the top 20 in happiness due to largely high healthcare costs, weak social safety nets, low trust, and social fragmentation. So it's not just high taxes versus low taxes, but how much social and economic security does a society provide and how is it funded? And so ultimately, happiness is strongly tied to how secure people feel, not just financially, but, socially, psychologically, et cetera.
Yeah. A lot of that's up in the air right now for a lot of countries.
Yeah.
Given all of the geopolitical issues for current.
Sure. Yep.
I mean, I can't imagine the people of Greenland are super happy right now.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to wrap up, and then I want to just take this to one other point. First of all, a few major insights here. One, happiness is multidimensional. It's not just about GDP. It's about health, trust, security, freedom, and community. The top-ranked countries do invest heavily in people. So when you look at the Nordic nations, they fund services like healthcare and pensions through the high taxes, and so they create a broad security and trust among the population. Some of the unhappiest countries struggle with fragility, meaning, say, conflict, weak institutions, and low revenue, which make it hard to build social safety nets.
Mm-hmm.
And Canada and the U.S. are kind of in the middle of the boat there. Both wealthy countries, but declining social connection and weaker welfare systems do affect happiness. And lastly, the social safety nets reduce fear and uncertainty. So reducing uncertainty is one of the most powerful ways to increase life satisfaction.
Mm.
So having said all that, and acknowledging that Canada does have relatively high tax rates, as I mentioned, certain provinces, you're looking at over 53% top marginal tax rates. In Alberta, I guess we're relatively lucky, 48% being the top marginal.
I liked it when I was 39, personally.
It was way better, yep. Way better at 39 than 48. I think Saskatchewan's around 47.5, so even better. If you choose to live in Nunavut,
yeah,
only 44%.
I'm not moving to none of it.
No?
No.
You're not having any of it?
No.
None of it at all? But I guess what I wanted to close with is that, despite high taxes in Canada, we shouldn't complain too much, because the government also provides for many opportunities for tax deferral and outright tax savings I'll call it legal tax avoidance over long periods of time through a variety of savings programs available. So let's talk about some of them.
Yep.
I guess the granddaddy of them all would be the Registered Retirement Savings Plan.
I don't know if it's the granddaddy or maybe it was just kind of the first to market.
The first to market.
Yeah.
And the oldest of the ones that I'm going to be discussing next.
Yeah.
So the RRSP is just a tax deferral tool. It allows you to make contributions to a savings plan that defers the tax paid the year you make a contribution until you actually withdraw those contributions from the account. Mm-hmm. And in between those periods, the account gets to grow tax-free. So it can make a significant contribution to a lifetime pension for somebody who is able to contribute, you know, each year.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a look at a hypothetical situation where somebody makes about an $80,000 annual salary a year, contributes the maximum each year for 40 years. So let's say somebody starts working and is able to save
18%
for 40 years, and just in constant dollars, so not worrying about inflation right now. That person could have over $2 million at retirement.
Yeah, but that person doesn't exist because that person that you just described,
yes,
you know, might get married, might get divorced, might have kids, might have pets, might have...
Absolutely. So this is the best case scenario that I'm describing. And as we talk about all of the different savings plans that are available, it's probably likely that not everybody can contribute maximally to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we hope that people can actually pick one that's most relevant to their situation and have a go at it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at RESPs, Registered Education Savings Plans. These plans allow you to contribute to an account or a savings account intended for a beneficiary's education. Typically, you know, parents might open these accounts for themselves or for their kids, but sometimes grandparents might open those accounts, et cetera. You can contribute $50,000 in total. But the way the program works is if you contribute $2,500 a year, you're eligible for the maximum grant, free money provided by the government, of $500 per year based on a $2,500 contribution.
Yeah, so it's 20% of the first $2,500.
Right.
Yeah.
So and the grant is limited to $7,200 a year or in a lifetime.
Yeah.
But, and so what I've assumed is that you contribute $2,500 a year, plus get the $7,200 grant for 18 years. The value available at the end of 18 years for your child, your beneficiary's education, is $95,000. Mm-hmm. That's 6% a year.
Right.
It's something that can contribute greatly to, you know, to future security. The tax-free savings account was introduced back in 2009, and currently, you're able to contribute $7,000 a year, and that amount gets adjusted with inflation over time. But for purposes of the, you know, of this discussion, contribute $7,000 a year for 40 years.
Yeah.
So you start when you're 25 and end at 65. That would grow to $1,148,000 at a 6% annual rate of return.
Yeah.
And that money would all be tax-free on withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, the newest savings plan introduced by the government a couple of years ago was the First Home Savings Account, which allows people 18 and over to contribute up to $40,000 to this account to be used specifically to buy their first home. And the maximum each year is $8,000. So let's assume that somebody is able to contribute $8,000 for 5 years to mm-hmm. get the maximum contribution. So you start at age 18, you contribute for 5 years. After 5 years, at 6%, you would have $47,800 in the account.
Okay.
Now, let's assume you left that money just invested until age 34, which is currently the average age for first-time home buyers in Canada. That value would grow to $90,000 at the end of that time frame. So at the time that somebody is looking to buy their first home, they'd have a $91,000 down payment.
Mm-hmm.
Which these days might not sound like a lot, but it would be a significant contribution to that first home purchase.
Sure. It's not going to get you the dream house in Vancouver.
No. No. Well, but it might get you a very nice starter home.
In Shaunavon, Saskatchewan.
Somewhere other than Vancouver and Toronto or Victoria or Kelowna. But
yeah.
Anyway, so my point being is that, yes, it's highly unlikely that, you know, a typical 18 or 25-year-old will be able to make contributions to all of these.
Yeah.
But the point is that these savings plans are available. They do allow people to defer or avoid taxes legally in the case of the tax-free savings account or the first home savings account for that matter. And so despite the fact that we do live in a relatively high tax country, there are opportunities to mitigate those and to save for retirement,
sure,
or save for major lifestyle goals, which would be education and owning a home.
Yeah. And to me, it's just another, it is the ultimate form of intergenerational wealth transfer.
Yep.
If it's available.
Sure.
Because you're right, like 18-year-olds typically don't have enough money to do RSP, TFSA, FHSA.
Absolutely. All,
like, they just don't, right?
Absolutely.
But, you know, we've got lots of clients that we're talking about gifting during
yep.
their lifetimes
sure.
to their kids and grandkids.
Yeah.
And funding your kids or grandkids' TFSA every year
yep.
is just a way of transferring the wealth.
That's right. And we are witnessing a huge wealth transfer from baby boomers who are now in their later years.
Yeah.
And again, many people, baby boomers or Gen Xers, are looking to provide a pre-death estate
mm-hmm.
to their kids in the form of, as you say, either help with a down payment on a house, contributions to RESPs or TFSAs and other things.
Yeah.
And so it is something that is becoming more prevalent and more beneficial to the younger generations.
Yeah. Actually, I had a meeting before we recorded this with a couple, a really nice couple, and their pensions pay for more than what their living expenses are.
Yeah.
So they don't touch anything,
mm-hmm.
right? As a matter of fact, they save like
yep.
$4,000 a month.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. And they're talking about what to do. And, you know, we're maxing out their TFSAs and they're beyond RSPs now. They're in RIFs. And I was talking about gifting to their daughter.
Yep.
And they kind of looked at me like I was crazy. But I was like, you know, you're bringing in more money monthly than you're spending.
Yeah.
And that's going to be like that for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is just an opportunity to help out the next generation.
Absolutely.
Right.
And for many people, it's like, well, I mean, if my kids get the inheritance when we die, it could be that their kids will be in their 60s.
Yeah.
You know, by the time they die. And you hope, of course, that they don't need the money in their 60s. They need it in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
It does start to factor in a lot more these days because of housing costs and things like that.
Sure. And I guess my point is, like, you know, was not being judgmental of
nope.
of this couple, just providing options.
Just an option. Absolutely.
You know, trying to provide efficiencies.
Right on.
Because it's just math at the end of the day.
That's right.
Right. Well, good one.
Well, so that's it for today. And well, until next time.
Are you still happy?
I'm so happy.
Are you happy with how that episode went?
I am. How about you?
Yeah, I'm reasonably happy.
Okay. Reasonably. Okay. All right. We'll discuss this afterwards, I guess.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, an exempt market dealer. Canvas is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals, and they have not been approved by, and are not necessarily those of, Q Wealth as a firm. This is not legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice, and should not be relied as such.